one is a transmission line and antenna. One of the things that I'm working on right now with one of my consulting clients, let me drop, is the fact that they have a requirement for transmitting extremely high-speed data over a easily constructed transmission system. And I'm advising those people to try to avoid microstrip. Because microstrip, the good news of microstrip as a transmission line is that it's quick and dirty and fast and cheap. That's the good news. The bad news is it is poorly shielded. If you are running two separate circuits side by side, and each one is on the surface of a multi-layer printed circuit board, and if each one of those circuits is using as a transmission line microstrip, you'll be amazed how much radiation is taking place from the microstrip and how much cross-coupling. A much better shielded system, for instance, would be what's called tri-plate strip line or coaxial cable. Two different systems, and there's many others. So when it comes to selecting what is the best kind of transmission line to convey your high-speed data or your radio frequency signal from point A to point B, there's a lot of individual characteristics that go into that decision. There are times it's not quite as simple as it sounds. And the next question someone's going to ask is, okay, what book do you go to that's going to give you that information? And the answer is the Book of Hard Knocks. After 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship of working with these circuits, you learn many of the tricks as to what works, how well it works, what doesn't work, and what works well. Let me drop this. There are very few books that'll give you that kind of information. The number of books that'll tell you what you want to know about radio circuits, I'm unhappy to say, it's not as high as you think. An amazing number of people who work in the world of wireless circuits and engineering and radio circuits have sitting on the shelf of their workspace the Radio Amateur's Handbook and the ARRL Antenna Book. Some of them will hide it because they think it's not an erudite book. They've gone to MIT or Stanford or Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute or Georgia Institute of Technology. These are very high-class schools of higher learning that have a reputation for doing a good job of teaching radio engineering, University of Virginia, among other places. And so these people might like to put on their shelf, you know, a book that's hard to pronounce the title or the author, and the Radio Amateur's Handbook might give them a heck of a lot more useful information. So by way of your exposure to ham radio and things like the technical net and your apprenticeship by working for a company that's doing that kind of work, you might learn 10 times as much radio engineering, real useful information. You might learn 10 times as much as graduating summa cum laude with a master's degree from one of those schools. That's a sad state of affairs. The schools really have to change the way they do it. And each time there's a conference held on that subject, usually the professors that are in charge of the curriculum will say, we have always done it this way, why should we change? To which the answer should be given to them, if you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always got. And that's not adequate. An amazing number of companies in the United States.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Boy, that's the third time I've done it tonight. An amazing number of companies in the United States are being forced to outsource their requirement for developing components and systems that use wireless engineering because there is an insufficient number of American engineers with that skill. And my pride in the United States hurts a little bit when I have to say that. There's not enough of those engineers with that skill. And many companies are saying about the only way we can hire people with that skill is to hire an enthusiastic ham radio operator who has built multiple antennas, tried various things, found out what works and what doesn't work. The hard school of knocks, so to speak. Okay, let's go over to Skyler. You're allowed to talk about any other subject, Skyler. KC2, WYP. The voice of Lindbergh, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. You got it, Skyler.
KC2, W2WIP. Hello, everyone. So I got my radio, I guess, as you can hear from the call sign. I'm pretty new. And not knowingly, I got a power supply that was only rated for 10 amps constant, it's a 12 amp surge, it's a pyramid power supply, and my radio manual says that when I'm transmitting, it draws 10 amps. But yesterday or the day before that, I was speaking to someone from, I think, Hewlett, and he was saying that if I have a good SWR, you know, connection, that my radio should only be drawing 5 or 6 amps when I'm transmitting. And I was wondering, you know, if that's true, and also, is it really bad that I'm drawing 10 amps, mass 10 amps while transmitting from a 10 amp constant power supply? Over to you.
That's a rather nice question, Skyler. When a manufacturer writes the specifications in the owner's manual, almost always that manufacturer will put in a safety factor. If his real radio on a good day draws 7 amperes, he'll tell you, please use a 10 ampere minimum capability power supply. And he's doing that just to make sure that in case there was some specmanship in the supplies that a person gets a hold of, the person might really pick up a power supply rated for 7 amperes, but really is only hum free up to 6.5 amperes, so to speak. So that's one thing going on. There's a safety factor. The second factor that's being addressed there by your friend that you talked to, let me drop, is that if you looked at the current drain of the final stage of a transmitter, a solid-state transmitter, when it's going into a pure 50-ohm load, in other words, you've got a good piece of 50-ohm cable, and your antenna is properly tuned for 50 ohms, maybe your transmitter total current drain will be, let me say, 7 amperes. That's a guess on my part, but it might be real. If you then apply a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in other words, there's a million ways you can make a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio for that particular experiment. Instead of a 50-ohm load resistor, you put a 25-ohm load resistor. That's a 2-to-1 difference in resistive impedance. Or the next experiment would be a 100-ohm resistor instead of the 50-ohm resistor. Again, a 2-to-1 difference. In the case of the 100-ohm resistor, the signal that reflects off of that resistor and comes back to the transmitter would be an in-phase signal. And when it comes to the 25-ohm resistor, what reflects off of that and comes back down the transmission line would be an out-of-phase signal. Well, that's just two of the ways of making a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. There's a very large number of ways. You can also do it by having a small amount of capacitor reactance and a small amount of inductive reactance. Let me drop. So a Smith chart is a kind of chart where all possible impedances are on that chart. Somewhere on that chart, every possible combination of high or low resistor or positive or negative reactance, meaning capacitive or inductance, every possible combination from zero to infinity in resistance and zero to infinity in positive and negative reactance, everything is on that chart. If you then drew a circle starting from the middle of the Smith chart, and you drew a circle of a particular diameter where on the left-hand side of the chart the circle goes through the 25-ohm resistor indication, and the other side of the circle will go through the 100-ohm resistor indication, every possible dot you could place along that circle of that particular radius on the Smith chart, everything on that circle would represent one of the many combinations giving you a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. I know that all of this is not going to make sense at first. And when you hear it a couple more times, Skyler, it'll make a little more sense. But what I'm getting at is, with the right kind of instrumentation, let me drop, I could put, for instance, a 25-ohm load resistor on the end of your piece of cable, but connect it through a trombone device. Trombone device is a kind of coaxial cable where as you pull and push on the mechanics of that trombone device, it changes its electrical length. It's like a piece of coax 50-ohm cable that can be stretched and shrunk without changing its impedance. When you do that, what you're literally doing with that trombone device is that without changing the load resistor, you selected a 25-ohm resistor because it makes a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, by operating that trombone, you will literally be walking around that circle I'm telling you you could draw onto that Smith chart. You could therefore see every possible impedance as you operate that trombone. I've done that experiment, and when you watch current drawn by a transmitter, you'll see that at certain settings of the trombone, in other words, at a certain area on the Smith chart, the current the transmitter draws is less than 7 amperes in my example. It might go down to 5 amperes in one part of the Smith chart, and it might go up to 11 amperes in another part of the Smith chart. So the magnitude of the standing wave ratio and the particular phase angle of the reflected power from that standing wave ratio has an effect on the final stage transmitting transistor of your transmitter and changes the amount of current it draws. So you can see this is another one of the variables that the manufacturer, let me drop. This is another one of the variables the manufacturer wanted to protect you from when he added a safety factor. If on average your transmitter drew 7 amperes, he's going to tell you use at least a 10 ampere power supply to be on the safe side. So right now, I'm not hearing any hum from your transmitter. It's a beautiful, clean sounding signal. One of the ways you can tell that you're overstressing a power supply is, number one, maybe it has an ammeter on it and you've pegged the ammeter. Number two, maybe it has a 10 ampere fuse and you blew the fuse. Number three, it gets extra hot when you're using it. And number four, most regulated power supplies, if you draw more current than they're rated for, your particular power supply is rated for 10 amperes continuous, and I'll bet you there's a safety factor on that from the power supply manufacturer. If it's a quality brand, it may really be good for 12 amperes, unless you're on a super hot mil-spec day, you know, 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the sun of Arizona, so to speak. And maybe there it's only good for 10 amperes. So maybe it's really good for 12 amperes. So if your particular power supply is good for 12 amperes and you drew 13 amperes out of it, most likely it will drop out of voltage regulation and start emitting a signal that has a hum on it. And therefore, we listen to your transmitter, we would know pretty fast. Let me drop. That's something like that's going on. So as you can see, Skylar, there's a lot of variables involved. There's a safety factor from your transmitter manufacturer. There's a safety factor on the power supply rating. There's a variation in the current you draw depending on what standing wave ratio you're going into. There's a variation in the current you draw depending on what phase angle, where on the Smith chart is that 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, so to speak. Where you're now emitting a beautiful, clean sounding signal with no hum, and assuming your power supply is not running real hot to the touch, and it's not blowing its fuses, I think you're worrying unnecessarily. It's good to be conservative, ask these questions and worry. And this particular thing, I don't think you've got to worry about. I think your next worry is going to be, how do you put up that rock crushing antenna in Lindbrook that's going to give you the real long-range DX that you'd like to get? KC2, WYP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, WYP. How'd you know? Well, the second day I had this radio, I started getting a humming noise, and someone actually mentioned it to me before I heard it, and I actually heard it through my speakers, and, you know, that it was only happening for a little bit, so what I did was I turned the power supply off, of course, and I took the wires off of, you know, I took the power wires from the radio off the power supply, and I put them back on, and it's been fine since then, and, you know, the power supply is, you know, it's warm, it's not hot. The fan's going in the back of my radio, which I guess is normal. But this hasn't happened since then. So I'm not too worried about that. And, right now I'm only using a mag mount antenna that I had used for scanning, but it's also rated for transmitting on 2 meters, 70 centimeters, and 800 megahertz. So I guess I'll have to get my dad to get up on the roof and on the side of the house to get that monster antenna before I can do anything else with it. KC2WIP, back over to Dick.
Very fine, Skyler. When you do get a hum from a transmitter, don't immediately jump into the assumption that the power supply is doing it. You could check on whether or not the power supply is giving you the hum. The elegant approach would be to connect a AC coupled oscilloscope probe to the 12 volt output of the power supply and look at the oscilloscope screen. There you would get a dynamic measurement of what is the wave shape and whether or not there's any hum. A real good power supply, like the one you're using, probably puts out a voltage regulation that's good to the nearest, maybe 5 millivolts. Maybe there's a 5 millivolt hum, which is an extremely small percentage compared to the 12 or 14 volts the power supply is putting out. So in the ideal world, you'd like to connect an oscilloscope to see if there's hum on the power supply. If you don't have an oscilloscope and you've got a very sensitive AC-coupled digital multimeter, quite a few of those will have an AC-coupled scale where they can measure millivolts of ripple on a power supply. And you might, in many cases, find out that when hum is coming out of a transmitter, it might not be coming from the power supply, or there are times when, because the antenna is located close to the power supply, and because some of the 2 meter or 440 megacycle signal coming out of that antenna is being coupled into the wiring of the power supply and gets into the voltage regulating chips and disturbs them, there are times when a power supply will put out a hum depending on where it physically sits compared to the antenna that's doing the transmitting. So a perfectly good power supply, if a strong enough radio signal is getting into it, could be creating hum. Let me drop. An amazing number of guys have cured that problem by putting a number of 0.001 disc ceramic capacitors, 1,000 picofarad or 0.001 microfarad disc ceramic capacitors from each one of the leads of the power supply down to the case of the power supply to act as a RF decoupling device, so that radio signal picked up by the wiring, the 12-volt wiring that goes over to your rig, doesn't get a chance to go back into the power supply and get inside into starboard circuits. So by putting my RF bypass capacitors on the power supply, you can fix that one. Occasionally a guy will be using an older rig where the coil cord on the microphone has been pulled on a few thousand times, and it's starting to, the wiring is starting to break contact, and the shielding of the microphone wire inside of the rubber case is starting to become degraded and breaking contact. You'd be amazed how many guys will pick up hum from their own microphone when they push and pull on the wiring where it goes into the socket on the front panel of the rig. So hum can be picked up from the microphone. Hum can be picked up by RF coupling into the power supply. Hum can be picked up because the power supply is being overloaded with current. And that's just some of the things that can make hum. And so with proper analysis, there are ways of dividing and conquering. I mean, you could plug in another microphone to see if the hum is still there. You could move the physical layout. Let me drop. You could change the physical layout of where is the power supply, where is the antenna, where is the rig located. There's a number of experiments you can do to eventually divide and conquer and find out which one of the sources of hum is it. In your case, you felt that it might have been the wiring itself that you disconnected and reconnected. I think that's unlikely. I think in the process of you unwiring and rewiring, you've changed what's called lead dress. The wiring from your 12-volt power supply now lies across your bench in a different way. The power supply is in a different location. The rig is in a different location. Maybe the antenna got moved. The total amount of radio signal picked up by that wiring that maybe is affecting the power supply changed. So you can easily have a red herring here, as they say. In other words, you make a change that you think is thoroughly unrelated and the problem goes away for mysterious reasons. Radio is strange stuff. Once a radio signal is emitted from an antenna, it goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. It bounces off of every dielectric and conductive and metallic object in that environment. If you could see that radio wave, it would be the equivalent of taking a great big basket full of ping pong balls that are perfect, and you throw that basket of ping pong balls, you violently throw it into the room, and these are perfect ping pong balls that are bouncing off of everything. If you could see that radio wave in a real environment like say for instance an industrial environment where you've got a whole bunch of people in individual cubicles with individual desks in their individual offices, those radio waves are bouncing off of everything. They're going everywhere. If you could see them, they're doing that. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of why when you make minor changes for the physical layout of things, you get sometimes a very different result. This is just one of the many tricks you'll be learning as you...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This is one of the many tricks you'll learn as you get exposed to these radio signals. This environment of radio that you've entered. And so, as I've said before, what goes on at this technical net is that Mel and Dick try to gather this this rabble of people. And when we get on particular subjects, quite often, a guy who was previously quiet sitting there in northern New Jersey says, hey, I know something about that. I ran into that situation. He chimes in, and he gives us the benefit of his particular experience. There's a lot of brain power out there, and we're attempting to tap into it. And so, silly as the questions may be sometimes, you'd be amazed, hidden inside of that question, what really is going on when we dig deep enough. And yes, I'm verbose, I'm long-winded, and there are a significant number of people who say, why the heck does he talk so long? Well, quite often, as you may have heard me say before, in the old days I used to ask people, do you want the brief answer or the long answer? And quite often people will say, please be brief on all your answers, but when you get to my subject, I want to hear the whole story. Now back to you for any further comments or questions, Skylar. KC2, WYP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WIP. Yeah, it's definitely a wealth of information I've, you know, attempted to take in the last two or three weeks that I've been listening. Not that I understand half of it, but yeah, I think my first mistake could have been that the antenna was actually sitting on top of the power supply. So right now I do have that on a cooking tin sitting on my floor, on the first floor of my house, which isn't too great. But, yeah, I guess I could have moved the wires, and just a few hours ago, I did move the power supply to a different place, and I moved the radio and everything, and I seemed to, you know, seemed everything to be fine. So, I guess that's it. Back over to you. To K2RIW, KC2WYP.
Wow. Skylar, you just said a mouthful. out of the mouths of innocent babes, so to speak. Wow, you just said a mouthful. If you talk to the people who have years of experience with radio circuits, you'll discover that not one of them per 50 guys would have the nerve to take a mag mount antenna and stick it to a power supply that is supplying the 12 volts to a transmitter. I mean, when you put the antenna close to the power supply, you're guaranteeing that the wiring is going to be picking up the strongest possible radio signal because the distance between the two is nearly zero. So the fact that you picked up hum when the antenna was mag-mounted to the power supply, my goodness, was that a terrible environment for that power supply. That's a beautiful explanation. It's probably not destructive. You probably could go back and duplicate that experiment, but I recommend you don't do it. As I said, the more experienced guys would never put the antenna within, let me pick a number, 5 or more feet of the power supply if you can avoid it. Unless you do some very heroic shielding of the power supply and all the wiring going to it. So that's a very easy explanation. I now give you a 90% chance that that's what you ran into, Skylar. And we're all smarter now because you did that, and I'm glad you brought it to our attention. Okay, I think I've answered all the questions of the people who signed in.
Not mine.
Okay, oh, how in the world could we skip Wesley? My goodness. Huh. I'll never do that again. N2XJN, go right ahead, Wesley. K2RIW in the TechNet.
November 2X, you did November for the TechNet. Okay. I have three questions. One of them, what number is taking the stand and giving a short negative opinion, like a sly fox who doesn't want to show his face and he doesn't want to be responsible for his words. And that's very much upsetting. What I'm trying to say, let me drop, that I understood from the short comment, like, no, this is not possible. Well, are you guys going to tell me, anybody, that it is impossible to create a very small resonance circuit around the telephone wire that carries on 60 volts when there is no ring and a 120 volts when there is ring, and it's modulated, and that resonance frequency circuit then from passive will become active and it will send the radio waves? Does anybody want to tell me that this is impossible? Dick, how would you how would you construct such circuitry? And to XGM,
when it comes to so-called telephone bugging devices, which is close to the subject you're discussing right now, boy, there's a lot of ways of doing it. But many of the bugging devices you would think would require a battery, and you'd have to go back to the sampled piece of property and replace the battery periodically. Well, a smarter design of the circuit uses the current and voltage that's available on the telephone circuit to charge it, to charge its capacitor or charge its battery. I think the ringing circuit is something like a 20 hertz sine wave. That's something greater than 90 volts on the telephone line. That's one of the main reasons why, let me drop, if you're following all of the rules for the code, so to speak, you will never put a telephone into a bathroom. Because in theory, if the telephone drops into the water that you're sitting in the tub, and then somebody rings that particular telephone, there is a chance they could give you a lot of grief. It's not easy, but it could happen. So there is essentially no building code that would allow you to install a telephone, a ordinary telephone, into a bathroom. A wireless phone, that's different. But a phone that's connected with wires to the outside world, now, you got to be very careful with any kind of electrical appliance you put into a bathroom because of all of the conducting surfaces of the faucets and the water and everything else, and the fact that you're not wearing a whole lot of clothing sometimes puts you at a lot of extra risk. But now, when it comes to methods of sampling the audio that's on a telephone wiring circuit, there's a zillion ways of doing it, and some of the ways that are very sophisticated are extremely difficult to detect. And so with a modern-day field... Let me drop. There are modern-day field-effect transistors where the input impedance to the gate of the transistor is numbers like 10 to the 10 ohms. That's almost a million megohms, so to speak. I own one of these sampling devices. You can buy it at Radio Shack, and all you have to do is hold it near the 60-cycle wiring of a piece of zip cord that goes between the wall and some particular appliance, and you twist the zip cord back and forth, and it will immediately tell you by the way it lights up its light-emitting diode on this little handheld device with the field effect transistor and a little bit of a small metal tab on one end. It picks up the presence of the 60-cycle electrostatic field that is nearby that particular piece of wire, because that piece of wire is plugged into Con Ed or Loco or New Jersey Power and Light or Connecticut Power and Light. You know what I mean. So there are sampling devices where you could be a long distance away from a circuit that contains 60-cycle power, audio, voltage signals, or whatever, and without disturbing the original wiring in any way, you could be sampling that conversation extremely well, and there would be essentially no way of detecting the presence of that so-called bugging device without actually going to that location and physically seeing it with your eyes. Other than that, you can make as many electronic measurements as you want on the wiring of that house, and you would probably not be able to confirm that that sampling device, that bugging device, is present. That's one of many things that you could be mentioning here, Wesley, when it comes to sampling somebody else's signals, there's only an infinite number of ways of doing it if you're smart enough. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much for your comments. I'm very much satisfied you said actually everything what I wanted to say. Now, another question for you is, did you, by the chance, review the Dr. Peter Linneman Tesla longitudinal electricity circuitry that I have sent you back to you?
Yes, I did. The most recent thing you sent me was a YouTube site that were in for a little bit longer than 1 hour. And it was a Tesla-like generator going into a very fancy wound coil where there was two turns in the primary, a wide piece of copper, and a large number of interwoven white turns made out of silver-plated coaxial cable for the secondary. And he built two of those coil mechanisms, and he was transmitting power and signals between the two. In one of those experiments, he was doing a kind of transmission from the input circuit to the output circuit, and they were separated by, in one case, he went down the beach around his house. I think he said he went 300 feet or 500 feet away from his house, something like 500 feet away from his house, and picked up the signal. So he was doing some very interesting radio-like and high voltage-like circuits, and one of his experiments, he sort of used the word ionic wind, and I think I knew what he was talking about, and I ran into that one and damaged my favorite digital multimeter. Tell you about that on the next go-around. So, yes, I did review that particular movie, N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. Well, Peter Linneman was very young at that time. That was 1988. And then later on, he became Dr. Peter Linneman, and he was very much active in constructing a number of devices in regards to the free energy. But I just wanted to mention that transmission of power over the air is nothing new. Sony actually put on the market something that is able to charge the batteries for a short a distance from the device that actually is in the interacting with that. The thing is that there was 3,000 feet. So that's what Tesla was trying to do before he was ruined by by J.P. Morgan. Is actually true. Let me drop. Now, another question that I have for you is, if you put on the table two magnets, and these two magnets, one has a one is south, one is north, and you put them, and then you put the piece of wire in it, creating the closed loop, and you put to both of the ends of this wire, the voltmeter, and you move it up and down, then you are going to see that the current flows in one way. Then, no matter if you reverse that coil, it's still going to flow the same way. And my question to you is, how does the current know the rule of the right hand, and find its own way always the same? You can reverse the polarity of the magnet, and the current will still follow that rule. Back to you.
I think you're getting into what's called Lenz's law. If I have a loop of wire, and magnetic field is going through the center of that loop, whether or not the magnetic field is increasing, you'll get one polarity of current flowing through the wire, and if the magnetic field is decreasing, you'll get the other polarity. And knowing the strength of the magnetic field, or the number of lines of force, and the rate at which they're changing, tells you how many volts the loop of wire picks up. That's Lenz's law. And I think you're really asking, at the molecular level, why does Mother Nature do that? Lenz's law explains the observed phenomenon. phenomena, but you're really asking why does it do that. Let me drop. And why is there any interaction at all between changing magnetic fields and electrostatic fields, or changing electrostatic fields and the creating of magnetic fields? Why is there that duality which Maxwell's equation supposedly explains? Maxwell's equations, you could say, is explaining an observed event which has been modeled, and it turns out that everything we know in science really boils down to a mental model that approximates the reality. The mental model that the Wesley and Dick come up with today that explains the observed results 99% of the time. Eventually, Alex is going to come up with a brand new experiment when he does his... I'm giving an example here. Alex is going to come up with a brand new experiment that explains what he sees with cardiovascular nerve interactions, and all of a sudden we're going to find out that our particular mental model is not good enough, and we're going to have to make the model different or elaborate or whatever. All of science is an approximation. It is a set of models which the models in theory get better as time goes on. Let me drop. Simply because what science really is an evolving body of knowledge that hopefully gives benefit to mankind and has as a major motivation the desire to explain, if I do this, I get that. And the model tries to explain why this input signal creates that output response. And from time to time, the models have to be changed. When it comes to the models of the universe, my goodness, has mankind made changes from the Ptolemaic system to the Copernican system to the modern-day systems. The model of the universe is getting more and more and more elaborate. When you study what's going on with the people who are looking at solid-state physics, or physics in general, at the microscopic or nanoscopic level with particle accelerating machines, and they try to find out what are the basic particles of all of matter, baryonic matter, dark energy, and so on. The models are getting more and more elaborate. Explaining it is not easy. Let me drop.
WS1.
All recognized. Let me drop again. No one has ever guaranteed that Wesley, Alex, Dick, Paul, Mel, no one has ever guaranteed that these guys are ever going to understand all of this jazz. Our degree of understanding is very relative. If we try real hard, my understanding tomorrow is going to be a little bit better today, but we're never really going to understand anything. One of the experiments that I've done quite a few times with the people who I trust and know pretty well is I say, okay, I'm talking to a man named John, we'll say, and I say, John, give me an example of something that mankind has studied, mankind understands it pretty well, and it's simple. You can't do that. Nothing is simple. You get down to the real layers. You look under the hood, so to speak, of this machine called the universe, and you'll find out that everything is complicated. There are a bunch of psychiatrists and psychologists out there who will take a very simplistic view, and they say, you engineers, you make everything complicated. Hey, fella, guess what? The universe is complicated. You're going to die before you understand any of it all the way. You're going to understand enough of it from time to time to give you some satisfaction. Let me drop that. So that some of your models work, and maybe you'll be able to make a dollar or a ruble with that knowledge. And maybe you'll be able to create some kind of a machine that other people consider desirable, and they will buy it from your organization, and therefore it's a win-win situation. Maybe that's going to happen, but you're never going to understand it all. We're going to try very hard. In my opinion, inside of every true ham radio operator, there is a scientist that's trying to get out. He's trying to understand this stuff. what is Mother Nature telling him. It's not a simple story. But those guys in I can't think of the name of the town that you live in right now. WS2N. Paul Ronkonkoma. Those guys in Ronkonkoma, they've almost got it figured out. WS2N, go ahead with your question, then I'll go back to Wesley. KQRAW, you got it, Paul.
Science, remember, not time out.
Okay, much for the sound. There we go. Yeah, well, that's because we don't, we're too far from Brookhaven National Lab. So we are closest, you know, to get into this subject. Tuesday, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland is going to start up. They tried it, you know, last year. It didn't work out too good. They had a magnet failure. But Tuesday, so look for the news. They're looking for the Higgs boson particle that will satisfy the standard model that exists today. Moving on to other theories, string theory, and M theory, and multiverses, they've got all these theories that are out there, Dick, but they want to be able to move on.
To go into the eastern input because you're very, very noisy. We're getting 90% of what you're saying, but the noise and the burst of noise because of the wind on top of Glen Oaks right now is making copy pretty difficult. Do you have the ability to go to the eastern input form?
Okay, let me try this.
Tremendous improvement. Fantastic. So the Hadron Collider, the one in Switzerland, which I think is, what, a 27-mile diameter, the biggest, most powerful machine mankind has ever created to do this work. I think about 2 years ago they turned it on. They had a magnet failure, and a lot of damage occurred. They repaired all of those, and I think they turned it on briefly at the low-power level, and I think you're telling me that this coming Tuesday they're going to start turning it on at higher and higher power. And they're going to start doing some real work with that machine. And they're getting down to the very basic particles in physics to try to find out what's below the basement, so to speak. I think that's what you're telling us, Paul. WS2N on the eastern input, K2RIW in the TechNet. Let the machine drop a little bit.
Okay, Dick, fine, yeah. According to the lecture that I went to, they had Dr. Takaki from Brookhaven Lab involved with accelerators. I knew all about this experiment coming up Tuesday at the LHC. I listened to him, Dr. who was also there. He was in charge of the Stony Brook College for quite a few years. And also charge of Brookhaven Lab when the RIC program was going. So these guys, they're all into this, and they're hoping to find the Higgs boson particle. It's some kind of a particle that, if they could prove that this thing exists, it will satisfy their standard model, and then they'll feel comfortable in going on to other theories, M theory, string theory, there's quite a lot of things that they want to really go on, but they'd like to prove this the standard model that they've looked at for years and believe is correct. They just need to fill in this missing piece, which they feel this thing in Switzerland, the biggest ever, should work seven times more capable of than anything that's been on the drawing board before. These particle accelerators. Let me drop it. atom smasher. They like to call it particle accelerator. Really twinge at that word, atom smasher. Atoms are so huge and big, and they want to talk about the real, very, very small and tiny particles. So they like to call them particle accelerators.
Hi, you made it sound like you attended a lecture at Brookhaven Laboratory in which some of this information as to when the machine is being turned on and what they expect to see. And I think some of the scientists at Brookhaven Laboratory on Long Island are involved in the CERN, the Great Big Hadron Collider. So was there a lecture at Brookhaven recently? And if so, how did you find out about it? Are you on one of their mailing lists? Did you see something on their website? I've attended a couple of lectures at Brookhaven Laboratory, and some of them in upstate New York, and some of them are very good. So tell me how you found out about this. When's the next one? And how do I find out about this, Paul? WS2N, the 2RIW in the TechNet.
No, this is the ICON group. What they do is science fiction and science fact. This is their 29th year at Stony Brook University. And I attended that today. Today they gave that lecture. Every year they have forums dealing with physics. You can go for, the latest and greatest thing that's happening in science fiction or find, sometimes there's a famous person, an actor there or producer or, that's done something that's fun. You can go for that. But I go for the, it was fun, these lectures. There's always at least three or four, five pretty good lectures given by these guys or somebody similar to it. So that's it. I missed the last couple of years, but I went this year. Back to you then.
Along those lines, Stony Brook University, on the very first Friday of every month, at the Earth and Space Science Building in Lecture Hall Number 1. Lecture Hall Number 1 is on the ground floor of the Earth, Space, and Science Building, and it has a lecture hall that holds 300 seated people. And so when they give a lecture on the subject of black holes, they fill up the 300 seats, and it's standing room only. There's about 350 or 400 people in that room. But every single first Friday of the month, it's a little bit hard to find it on the Stony Brook website, but if you're on their mailing list, once you find them, they will tell you which one of the people from their astronomy department, their astrophysics department, is going to give the next lecture. They're free of charge. They start off at 7:30 at night. The lecture lasts for 1 hour. Let me drop. The lecture lasts for 1 hour, and weather permitting, at the end of that 1 hour lecture, they go up to the fourth floor roof of the Earth, Space, and Science Building, and they set up approximately four Schmidt-Cassegrain 8-inch diameter telescopes, plus the main telescope they got there, which I think is a 24-inch telescope. And they'll set them up looking at Saturn and Jupiter and various things. Albireo, the blue-gold star coming in. So those lectures are free of charge. Turns out every single Friday night of the month during the school year, there is some other lecture. The first Friday of the month is always the astronomy department. I think the second one is the physics department, and the third one is the social sciences and so on. So once you get on their mailing list, or once you find their website, you can find out who's giving the next lecture. They're all free of charge, open to the public, and the price is right. And some of them are extremely good. I'm a little bit amazed that the machine is timing out periodically while I'm talking. And seems like it's a very short timer going on right now. So, the ICON that you went to, this was the 29th annual ICON. I'm kind of curious, did did you, it probably starts at 8 o'clock in the morning on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Probably goes until 10 o'clock at night. Some of it is Japanese cartooning. Some of it is costuming. Some of it is, a lot of it is science fiction. And some of it is science fact. What was the price of admission? And give us a couple of words as to what it was like when you attended today, Paul. Because was there a lot of people? Did they fill up the lecture hall, so to speak? WS2N, K2RIW TechNet. Watch you watch.
Okay, understood. Yeah, well, two lectures I went to, one in a very small room that had about maybe 50. And then the following one was, I would say that room could probably hold maybe 70 people. I would say there were 40 people in that room. So you could hear a pin drop. You probably had a good audience. And from the questions that they were asking, I could tell they were very, very knowledgeable, the group. In fact, one guy from the first lecture became one of the people sitting in the group and in the crowd watching the second lecture. So, we drop it. On 3 days, Friday, Saturday, yeah, Sunday. Sunday they end like 6 o'clock. I don't think any later than 7, I think around 6 o'clock. But I went earlier in the day, you know, around noon. So, it's unfortunately, it's gotten very pricey. You know, one day ticket is like $30. That's they're getting up there due to the economy. I don't think they could afford it where they happened years ago. But since I've gone to previous ones, I could say it was probably just as crowded. Maybe not as crowded. I think it was more weather related. It was pretty cold today, especially up there. Cold, breezy. Did start to rain at one point. Back to you, Dick. WS to win.
Yeah, I wanted to finish.
I know. We're going to get back to you in a minute, sir. Wesley. Sounds like you had a good time there. And the fact that it's getting pricey, like $30 for a ticket, doesn't surprise me, Paul, because in past years, they lost money. So they're trying to break even. I know some of the people who are involved with it, and some of these people were putting their own money into the project called the ICON at Stony Brook University. And so when you lose a few thousand dollars out of your own pocket because of your enthusiasm to put on a science fiction show, that hurts. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they're starting to charge more money. Another thing that's coming up, other than every single Friday night, the first Friday of the month, which is at the Stony Brook University on the subject of the astronomy department, and almost all of those lectures are very good ones. Let me drop. That's worth going to. As I said, the price is right, and there's other geology and astronomy, and every single Friday night is one of those. Another thing to look forward to is the NEAF, Northeast Astronomy Forum, which this year is going to be, I think it's the 30th annual or something like that, but it's April 17th and 18th at Rockland Community College. If you have the slightest interest in astronomy, you do want to go to that. It is the equivalent of a Dayton Hamvention as far as astronomy is concerned. It's one of the largest ones, the largest forum of this type in the United States. They take the huge gymnasium of Rockland Community College, fill it up with, oh, I'm going to guess, about 75 or 90 vendors of telescope materials. Let me drop. So if you think you're ever going to own a telescope, a camera connected to a telescope, because you want to do low-light astrophotography, of all the zillions of little doodads that work with telescopes and binoculars and tripods and cameras and whatever, or laser pointers. There's five vendors of real potent laser pointers. I own a laser pointer that I bought there a couple of years ago, which I think puts out something like 20 or 30 milliwatts. And you've got to be a little bit careful where you aim the thing. But my goodness, does that make a light sword, a green laser at nighttime. And you can see the beam coming out of that for a few hundred feet. You could have a whole crowd of people that are all gathering. And you want to point to a particular star. You do that with your bright green laser pointer at nighttime. And everybody knows exactly what star you're talking about. So that show, Northeast Astronomy Forum, NEAF. As I said, April 17th or 18th, Saturday and Sunday, Rockland Community College. That's just, 20 minutes or so above New York City. That's worth attending. And there's one other thing that is worth attending. Oh, yes. Let me drop. If you have the slightest interest in engineering consulting, free of charge, the very first Wednesday of every month, at Briarcliff College in Old Bethpage, the IEEE Long Island Consultant Network, which consists of 40 paid members, and all they probably get about 5 or 10 guests on the average first Wednesday of the month. You go there at 6:30, I think it is when they start. They give you a free meal. It's open to the public, and you can sit and listen to what consultants are doing right now. They literally help each other with their consulting business. I've been a member of that group for 10 years. Real good group of guys. You just sit there and turn on your tape recorder and listen to these stories about what kind of consulting these people have done, what kind of interesting problems they've run into, how they solve them. If you want to do networking, if you think you're ever going to be an electrical engineering consultant, and they break it down into 42 separate skills, things like computers and power supplies and the fiber optics and the radio and so on. The rarest skills that's there, of the 42 skills and of the 38 or 39 members that are present right now, let me drop. It seems like at any one instant of time, only two or three of those consultants claim significant wireless capability, RF engineering capability. Only two or three of those 38 or 40 consultants claim that as a skill. Those are the ones that work continuously. They are never out of work, whereas some of the other consultants have to do a significant amount of cold calling and advertising and whatever in order to find work. So a lot of education can come from going to Briarcliff College the first Wednesday of the month, 6:30, at the so-called the large lecture room at Briarcliff College in Old Bethpage. Again, the price is right. They'll supply you a meal. They'll give you a whole lot of information. You'll enjoy it if you have any technical interest. So those are some of the things. Stony Brook, Briarcliff, and the Northeast Astronomy Forum at Rockland Community College. Now, let's go back to what Wesley was talking about. So, as you can tell, Wesley, we're never going to understand the real bottom line of any of these things. Built into every scientist, there is a model that partially explains his universe. And if the guy is an adaptive scientist, that model will continue to change, improve, and get more complicated as time goes on. Just simply explaining how changing a magnetic field induces a voltage in a wire. Lots of rules of thumb and equations explain the observed results, what's really happening at the molecular level, and why does Mother Nature behave that way? You're asking an awfully deep question, which is not going to easily be answered. N2XJN, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
Okay, November 2XJ, Juliet, November for the net. Well, talk to you about the wire in between two magnets. And that when you move up and down that wire, actually it knows, the current knows which way to flow. So according to conventional teachings, this electric current flow is not the result of magnetic field. as the magnetic lines of force were supposed to be imaginary, consisting of potential energy, not kinetic energy. So it becomes clear that the conventional teaching is wrong.